Good afternoon. I'm calling the Minnesota House Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee to order. And I thought we would start out with introductions. We'll start over. Just introduce yourself, and if you want to, you mention, well, these cities, you know, just sure. Give us a little insight.
Yeah, hi. Representative Bianca Vernig. I represent 52B, Egan, Mendota Heights, and Mendota.
Forgot about the Senate rules. Representative Emma Greenman, I represent 63B, which is the sort of south swath of South Minneapolis. This is my third term on Elections Committee, and I'm happy to be here.
Hi, I'm short for one thing. Representative Nathan Coulter, I'm in my second term serving District 51B, which is basically the eastern half of the city of Bloomington.
Hi, I'm Representative Patty Akam. I represent House District 45B, which is Minnetonka, Wayzata, Deep Haven, Shorewood, and Woodland. I'm on my fourth term and my first term on elections. Glad to be here.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Liz Lee from St. Paul. I represent the eastern part of our capital city. This is my second term and second time serving in the committee of Chair Quall.
Mike Freiberg, I represent District 43B, which is all of Golden Valley and Robbinsdale, part of Crystal and Plymouth. Glad to be here.
Representative PM Altendorf, Red Wing is my area, District 20A, Wabasha, Cannon Falls, Lake City. Good to you.
Rebecca Reiners, Committee Legislative Assistant.
Dwayne Quam, I believe it's the eighth term, and I've been multiple terms on this committee, and in fact served with former Representative Simon my freshman year, I believe.
Pat Kaluza, I'm the GOP committee administrator.
Will Golding, Republican Research.
Representative Jimmy Gordon, District 28A, that's Isani County and a little bit of Chisago County.
Representative Drew Roach, District 58B, first term. I represent areas of Dakota, Goodhue, and Rice County.
Representative Ben Davis from District 6A, which includes portions of Itasca, Cass, and Crow Wing County.
And I would like the nonpartisan staff to introduce themselves and also we missed one gentleman on the other side, so nonpartisan staff.
I'm Buddy
Mac
Aaron from
I'm Helen
Roberts from the Health Assistant Staff. Chelsea Griffin, Housing Secretary.
Jennifer Hoffman, Housing Secretary.
Jennifer Hoffman, Housing Secretary.
Jennifer Hoffman,
Housing Secretary.
John Buehler,
Gatewell
Research.
Chris Holdorf,
Okay, and I will be introducing the pages later on in the committee, but I do know that Secretary of State probably has activities outside this committee. And so what we're going to do for newer members, the testifiers will give their name and their title or office or who they're representing and then testify. And Secretary of State, go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Great to see everyone back together. For the record, my name is Steve Simon. I'm Minnesota Secretary of State. I'm joined here today by our Elections Director for the State of Minnesota, Mr. Paul Linnell. And to my right, your left, is Mr. Bill Ekblad. He is our Elections Security Navigator. With me also today, seated here to my left, is someone familiar to many of you, at least returning members and staff, and that's our Government Relations Director, Nicole Freeman. We really appreciate the committee's invitation to be here today. Unfortunately, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your understanding, I have an overlapping meeting and commitment scheduled at this time, so I won't be able to stay for the whole hearing, but you know I'll be back. So I'm always available to any of you, and for the legislators who don't know, I'm available to you always, and some of you, I'm glad, have taken me up on it. You can call me or text me on the weekends, in the evenings. If you don't have it already, I'll get you my mobile number, my personal mobile number, so I'm always available to you. If you have issues, questions, pushback, feedback, anything you want. And if you want to set up a meeting, well, we can always do that anywhere you want. So I will definitely be back. Chair Quam, I want to thank you for allowing the office to present and so that I could join you for just a little bit. Just to give an overview of what to expect, I just want to give you a little bit of a roadmap. First, I'm going to present the office's elections-related budget request, some high-level statistics, and a summary of the three statewide elections held last year. And additionally, I'll highlight some of the outreach efforts that our office has been engaged in that I know you wanted to hear about. Mr. Lindell will then give you a deeper dive into the election administration components and how they played out during last year's elections. And then Mr. Ekblad will give an overview of the work that his team does to support the physical and cybersecurity of our elections here at the state and with our local partners in counties and cities. So I'll start out right now just with the office's budget request that is applicable to this committee's jurisdiction. As you may be aware, and I know returning members are, our budget is divided across a number of different committees, so we're just going to discuss the one that is in this committee right now. And it has to do with the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA. Mr. Chair, you're well familiar with this, I know. It was passed in 2002 with broad bipartisan support. And what's happened since 2002 is that the federal government from time to time, it's not like clockwork, it's not on a schedule, but from time to time the federal government will appropriate funds to the states and the territories in the United States for particular purposes that have to do with elections. So the HAVA grants really shifted in their purpose starting in about 2018. And since that time, they've been designated for election security purposes. So this funding, it provides resources to improve election administration for federal offices and elections, including enhancement of technology and the ability to make certain election security improvements. And since the first HAVA dollars were appropriated some 20 years ago or so, a state match has always been required. So they want states to have some skin in the game. It's not just we're writing you a check. It's we're writing you a check, but you have to come up, you, the states, have to come up with some percentage. It's typically, as it is this year, 20%. So what we're faced with right now is we have to submit a work plan to the federal government for this money. It's not just that we get it because we're a state. We've got to submit a work plan, how we plan to spend it. And then additionally, on the back end, we have to do periodic reports to the Election Advisory Commission, or EAC, which is a federal agency. So they audit us. They ask questions of us. We have to tell them how we're spending the money, how we're metering it out, and do periodic reports for them. So in March of 2024, Congress passed its latest round of HAVA election security grants. That's pretty typical. In election years, they'll typically, these last few years, certainly the last, I'd say, eight or so, they'll give a burst of funds. This last one overall, this is the national figure, was $55 million. It's always prorated by population. And so our share of that was $1 million, just about. And the 20% match would mean $200,000. So the intended use of these dollars is to continue funding our election security navigator team, that's Mr. Ekblad's team, and support the work that they do. So we received the funding in April of 2024, and we have 2 years to come up with a state match. You've been through this before, Mr. Chair. So it's $200,000. That's one-time money, obviously, so it doesn't go on the books. There are no tails. It's just one-time money. So today we asked for the committee's support in this request to unlock all of that $1 million in federal grant money. So that's it in terms of the money part that's in this committee's jurisdiction. There are other committees where we have other funds, but that concludes sort of the budget portion for this committee. I want to say a bit more then about the 2024 election, and you're going to hear much more from these two gentlemen on either side of me. But just basically speaking, from 30,000 feet, back in 2023, when 2024 was looming, and we all knew it was going to be a big presidential election, a lot of participation, a lot of interest, a lot of passion, and that's to be expected and normal and natural, I said for a long time that I had two goals for the 2024 election, two goals. And my two goals for the 2024 election from an administrative standpoint, forget the politics and who's winning and losing and candidates, but administratively I had two goals. And those two goals were high turnout and low drama. That's what we wanted, high turnout and low drama. And you'll notice I didn't say no drama. I think that would be foolish and naive. There's always going to be some drama, but we wanted low drama. And I think both of those wishes were granted. We did have very high turnout. As of the end of last week, we were number one in the country, again, in voter turnout, pending some final numbers from Wisconsin. They could overtake us, but for now at least, we're unofficially number one in the country. And, you know, it isn't just the high turnout, it's that we have great partners around the state. Putting on an election is a team sport. As many of you know, we don't count votes. We don't touch ballots during an election, ever. That all happens in the townships, in the cities, and in the counties. Tens of thousands of people, typically your friends and neighbors who are doing the counting, and they did a really, really great and thorough job. So just as an overview, it seems like a long time ago, but the 2024 election cycle really got underway really late in 2023 in preparation for the statewide presidential nominating primary on March 5th. And just to remind those of you who follow this stuff, you know, in the presidential election year, we're asking our partners at the cities, the counties, and the townships to do a pretty extraordinary thing. Every 4 years, we ask them to run not two, but three statewide elections. You've got the regular, the general election, of course, you've got the regular primary, but then you also have the PNP, the presidential nominating primary. And some of you represent counties where I know that it isn't the most convenient time for them. It's in the middle of property tax season. And as you know, out of our 87 counties, we only have 9 counties in the state of Minnesota that have full-time, year-round, elections-only departments. They tend to be the biggest counties. And most of the rest of your counties, as you know, the person who does elections probably wears a lot of other hats. They might do property tax collection. They might do ditch and drainage work. They might do inspections of some kind. They're busy people. And so it's asking a lot of them in presidential election years, but they did a very, very good job. At that time, Minnesota had 3 qualifying major political parties, and each party's candidates appeared on a separate ballot. So counties had to produce 3 ballots for each precinct. Turnout for that election, the presidential nominating primary, was pretty low. It was 13.6% of the voting eligible population. That's about, just shy of 586,000 ballots cast. This last March 5th election was the first one that required voting instructions to be translated into the 3 languages most commonly spoken across the state after English, so they were made available in Hmong, Somali, and in Spanish. And in addition, translated sample ballots were available in applicable languages in any precinct that was designated as a language minority district. 30 counties across the state had at least one precinct that fell within that designation. So on the next slide, we had township elections that were held the week after the presidential nominating primary, and various special elections were held on the uniform election dates in April and May. The next statewide election, of course, was the primary on August 13th, which we always have. That's not a new one, of course. There, we had about just shy of 544,000 Minnesotans cast a ballot, again, about 12.8% of the voting eligible population. On June 1st of last year, the provision passed by the last legislature that allowed voters to sign up to be permanent absentee voters went into effect. So voters sign up for this designation and will automatically receive an absentee ballot for every election for which they're eligible until and unless they say they don't want to do it anymore. So as of a couple weeks ago, we had about 99,000 voters in Minnesota who have selected to be a permanent absentee voter. So last June, the office also expanded the language offerings on our online voter tools. This didn't require a statute. This wasn't a law that all of you passed. This was just something we did as a matter of providing ease to voters. So now all that information is accessible in 10 additional languages, allowing folks to complete these processes in the language that they're most comfortable with. So for example, an eligible Minnesotan now can register to vote in Hmong. And so you can see that there. Or another example, somebody can track their absentee ballot in Vietnamese. So voters can also check their registration status and request an absentee ballot in 11 languages, including English. And these translated tools complement the 10 foreign language pages that have been available on our website since about 2016. The website is mnvotes.gov. Mr. Linnell will do a deeper dive into the general election, but I just want to give you a few highlights. So overall, bottom line, we had, as you can see here, 3,272,414 Minnesotans cast a ballot in the November 5th election. That was about 76.4% and has us at this point winning over Wisconsin for the number one slot, but their final numbers are coming in. It's possible they could pass us, so we're either number one or number two. This is the interesting thing to me, at least. We had a little over 1.3 million Minnesotans vote before Election Day. That's 39%. That's high. 39% of Minnesotans chose to vote by absentee, either by mail or in person, before Election Day. And that's really interesting to me because it was hovering around a quarter before COVID. Then it shot way, way, way up in the COVID election of 2020. It was 58% in the COVID election, meaning for the first time in state history in 2020, you only had a minority of voters, 42%, who voted on game day in the polling place the traditional way. Now, that number came back down to earth again in 2022 to about a quarter. I think it was 26%. But here it shot up 13 points in the 2024 election. So now it's knocking on the door of 40% of Minnesotans who have chosen to vote sometime before Election Day, whether that's in person or by mail. It's interesting. You know, there are all sorts of reasons why people choose that, and that's a whole separate hearing. I want to talk a little bit about voter outreach because I've been asked to talk about that. It's a small team. We have a mighty team of two people, full-time, permanent staff members in our office, and they typically add a temporary staff member to their ranks for the election season. One of the events that our office has been involved in for years that's been quite popular is the Students Voting Program. We partner with the YMCA, their Center for Youth Voice. So every 2 years, K-12 schools across the state are invited to participate in a mock election. It used to be just for high schools. We started this in 2016, and it was just high schools. But in partnering with the YMCA, we can now cover more territory. So now any school that wants to do it, they don't have to, but many students choose to. This year, we had 439 schools participate. Over 131,000 students votes cast, and you'll see here a few of those students are shown here. This dashboard showcases the turnout and other data. This is on our website too, from the mock election, and we really appreciate all the schools participating this year. Next slide. Our office also assisted with the planning of Youth Day at the Capitol. This is something we've been part of for a lot of years as well. About 600 secondary school students attended last year. I know a fair number of legislators typically stop by. Maybe some of you did on this committee as well. They met other youth leaders from the Minnesota Youth Council, and after a bit of advocacy training, they visited with legislators. So a lot of constitutional officers spoke to the group. I did, and others did as well. Every September, I'm proud to help us celebrate National Voter Registration Day. This is a longstanding, nonpartisan national effort. Equal amounts of Democrats and Republicans on their National Advisory Committee. This year, the office organized for the first time a virtual statewide high school pre-registration and registration event. We had 165 high schools receive materials from the office to support events at their schools. 45 participated on the day itself in a live Zoom event. I was able to travel to two high schools in person and two college campuses that way. I went to Black Duck High School, to Bemidji State, to St. John's in St. Joseph, and to St. Cloud Tech High School on that day. So this was a great way to knit together a lot of schools across the state, colleges and high schools. The last legislature passed a requirement that public high schools and all colleges that accept state aid must send a dedicated communication in the fall and spring to all students about pre-registration and voter registration. So our office just worked to remind schools of that legal requirement. In addition to information about new legislative requirements, our office worked throughout the year to communicate resources on voter engagement and civic education to colleges and universities across the state. Typically, we have a lot of social studies teachers who are very interested in integrating this into their curriculum, particularly as election time nears. It's something that gets students' attention, so they tell us, and they just want information that they can pass along to students. The office was a supporter, as you know, of the Restore the Vote legislation that was passed in 2023, which restored the vote for eligible Minnesotans who have left prison behind. It's about 55,000 Minnesotans, and the office worked with partners across the state to spread the word about this change. We just wanted to make sure people knew what the law was. You know, you can't make anyone vote. But you can tell them what the law is. And there was a lot of confusion out there, as you can imagine. Some people came from other states where the law was different, or they were in Minnesota and they hadn't yet heard that the law had changed. So we just wanted to make sure that everyone knew what the law was. Whether they voted or not, that's their business, but we just wanted them to understand what the law was. So, for example, we partnered with community groups and nonprofits and folks all across the state just to get the word out. Our role, and you appropriated money for this purpose, so thank you for that, our role was to send a letter to all likely eligible impacted individuals. The letter explained the law change, reminding folks of the voter eligibility requirements in Minnesota, and that if they met them, invited them to register either on the provided form or online. So I had the opportunity to visit all of the state correctional facilities. I went to all 11. I want to thank Commissioner Schnell for joining me at many of these visits. And when I was there, I was able to meet with a lot of the folks who had 1 year or less of incarceration remaining. And I was clear in these visits that it's every person's right to choose the right to vote or not to vote. The right to vote is also the right not to vote. It might be low on someone's list, right? Once someone leaves incarceration, there are other things that maybe they're more concerned with, and I acknowledge that. But during my time at each facility, I tried to answer questions about voting, but also about the lawmaking process. You all should know they were very interested. I was surprised by this. A lot of questions about how legislation and legislating works. How do you get a law passed? Who does it? Who votes on this? What are the circumstances? So they might be following up with many of you on that. So the slide that you're seeing now, I think, highlights several of the other ways that I and the office staff engaged with the Department of Corrections staff, probation officers, attended community events, and incorporated some of this information into each of the 79 public-facing events that happened last year. So there's continued work to be done. I'm grateful to our staff and our partners across the state for the work that they've done over the last 2 years or so on this issue and other issues. And I'll just end where I began, which is putting on an election is a team sport. We have a limited set of roles in our office, but really so much of the work is done in the counties, in the cities, in the townships, by people who are often stretched thin, but really do a good and conscientious job, an ethical job. They work hard, they want to get it right, and they do get it right. And I'm grateful to them. Every election, we need tens of thousands of people. Just election judges alone, we need 30,000 people to sign up for that work. 30,000. That's a small army, and that's not including the permanent folks in the counties, cities, and townships for whom this is their job year-round. So we're grateful to all of them for delivering what I think was a really high-quality election. So with that, I'm going to leave you in the capable hands, first of Mr. Linnell and then Mr. Ekblad, to say more and dive in a little bit more deeply. But I'll be back, Mr. Chair, and I want all legislators to know I'm happy to meet with you, text with you, have a phone call with you anytime on any of your issues, questions, concerns, pushback, anything you have. Thanks for your time and attention, Mr. Chair, and thank you for understanding that I have to get to something else. But I'll be back. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And just in the future, if apparently we didn't get your presentation in time to be able to print off copies for the members, we're going to generally do that. But I noticed the your escorts came to the two side doors. I was making it humorous about the because of things that have happened in other committees, there are some people that check and make sure that everything's going well. But we will see you back sometime,
okay,
not too distant future, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members.
Is it Mr. Lindell that's going to start out?
Correct, yeah.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Linnell, and I'm the Director of Elections for the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State. I've been with the Office of the Secretary of State since 2022. I've been in my current role since July of last year. Before coming to the office, I served as the elections lead in Anoka County. So election administration, as Secretary Simon said, is a true partnership between the Office of the Secretary of State, the 87 counties, and the thousands of cities, townships, and school districts in Minnesota. I'll now walk through some of the key elections duties at the different levels in the state. The Secretary of State serves as the chief election official for the state and carries out the official duties prescribed by law, including serving as the chair of the state canvassing board that certifies state elections. The office is responsible for training county election officials and making training materials available for use in training municipal election officials and election judges. The office is also responsible for hosting and administering the statewide voter registration system, or SVRS. County users access this system to enter and update voter registration and absentee ballot information. This database interfaces with data that's received from several agencies to keep voter records up to date, including Driver and Vehicle Services, the Social Security Administration, the Department of Health, Department of Corrections, and the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC, a consortium of states that share data on voters that have moved in and out of states to keep our voter rolls up to date. In addition, our office administers the annual list maintenance process in SVRS each January. And through this process, voter records are inactivated if they have not had voter activity for the last 4 years. Our office also maintains the candidate filing database and election reporting system. For the statewide election dates, information from the affidavits of candidacy is entered by state and county users into the election reporting system and then posted to the publicly accessible candidate filings website. On election night, county users enter unofficial results data into the election reporting system, which is then posted to our publicly accessible election night reporting webpage. Our office is also responsible for certifying the voting equipment in use in Minnesota's elections. Before any electronic voting system is used in Minnesota, it must first be tested and certified by a test lab that is accredited by the bipartisan Federal Elections Assistance Commission. This is a rigorous testing process that includes system examination down to the source code. Once federally certified, vendors apply to have their systems tested and certified by the Office of the Secretary of State. Our office reviews the federal test lab reports and information about the voting system before advancing to the demonstration testing phase. Several requirements are outlined in Minnesota statutes and rules that voting equipment systems must demonstrate before they're certified. If the voting system successfully meets all the requirements provided in Minnesota law, then our office certifies the equipment and notifies counties that the system is available for use in Minnesota's elections. 4 electronic voting system vendors are currently certified in Minnesota: Election Systems and Software, Democracy Live, Dominion, and Hart InterCivic. Our office also performs post-election performance reviews of counties that are randomly selected at the state canvassing board meeting following each state general election. Those reviews will take place in the coming weeks and will help to provide valuable feedback to improve election administration training and procedures in future election cycles. Secretary Simon highlighted some of the work that our office does to facilitate voter outreach and make our elections more accessible for all voters. Our office also has rulemaking authority to prescribe administrative rules that provide additional guidance for carrying out the requirements in statute. Our office is not a legal advisor or enforcement agency. Election law violations are filed and investigated at the local level. The counties are at the core of our election administration system in Minnesota and carry a large set of responsibilities. They are the ones who enter, process, and update voter registration records. Counties are also responsible for ballot development. Our office provides county election officials with training and resources on the ballot development and proofing process, but counties work directly with their vendors to manage the design, layout, and printing of ballots. In a presidential year, ballots cannot be finalized until late August. This is when the major political parties must submit their candidates for president and vice president, along with the names of their electors. This also coincides with the deadline for minor parties and independent candidates to submit nominating petitions to get their name on the ballot for president. Once all contests and candidates have been finalized, counties can work with their vendors to prepare and proof the ballots. In 2024, there were a handful of counties that had errors on their ballots that required corrective actions through the courts. A major contributing factor
the public, a handful is what quantity, and if it's a small enough quantity, what counties?
I don't have that in my notes to have the counties and number on hand, but I'm sure we can get that for you, Mr. Chair.
It's just when there's something like that that happens where there's an issue, it's nice to know how broadly that issue, how expansive, and it does matter a little bit if it's a county that has, you know, 100, 200,000 votes, as opposed to a smaller one that is most likely volunteer, as opposed to having full-time elections. Those kind of things can help us as a committee to understand how we can better prevent issues in the future and improve the feeling of election integrity. So, I would hope that you would be able to send that shortly. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We can certainly get that information for you and for members of the committee. So a major contributing factor in these errors was a new process that was put in place by one of the ballot vendors operating in Minnesota. They were admittedly underprepared and under-resourced to provide timely and accurate ballot proofs to all of the counties using their services for the 2024 general election. When ballot errors were identified, county election officials and county attorneys moved quickly upon learning of the mistake and took swift action to file a petition with the courts. Our office supported counties and provided guidance on this process when requested. Counties were able to obtain court orders to get the ballots corrected and provided the appropriate remedy to the small number of voters that had already submitted an absentee ballot. It's always regrettable when a ballot error is not identified and corrected before it's printed and in the hands of voters. We've met with the vendor multiple times during and after the election cycle to review what caused the errors to take place. Corrective action has been identified to ensure that they're prepared to provide timely and accurate ballots for their customers for all future elections. Our office will also be redoubling efforts to continue providing training and resources for county election officials on the ballot proofing process. Counties are also primarily responsible for purchasing, programming, and maintaining voting equipment. This includes the rigorous testing process that takes place prior to each election before it can be used. During preliminary testing, every ballot style to be used on a tabulator, whether for counting absentee ballots or at the polling place, must be included in a preliminary test. For preliminary testing, test decks are created that include marking unique vote totals for candidates in each contest and confirming that those test results match how the ballots were marked. Other features must be tested as well, including overvotes, undervotes, and crossover votes to confirm that the equipment is counting ballots correctly. Jurisdictions must also conduct a public accuracy test of the voting equipment. As the name implies, the public is welcome to attend these tests to see the voting equipment in action and confirm that it is counting votes accurately. There are minimum requirements for the number of precincts that must be tested as part of the public accuracy test, and testing must be error-free in order for the equipment to be used at the election. Counties are responsible for administering in-person absentee voting and absentee voting by mail. Counties also serve as the training authority for municipal election officials and election judges. After the polls close on election day, counties compile election results from the polling places and from absentee voting and enter the unofficial results into the election reporting system. In the days that follow, counties are responsible for the post-election canvassing process to certify the election and to complete the post-election review. Cities and townships are responsible for determining their precinct boundaries and polling place locations. They're the employer for election judges, managing the recruitment and appointment of election judges at the polling places. Some municipalities have additional responsibilities if they've been designated by the county to include training and certifying election judges, administering absentee balloting, and administering healthcare facility voting. In Minnesota, we're fortunate to have a great group of dedicated election officials at all levels across the state. Unfortunately, in recent years, we have seen some challenges with increased turnover among election administrators. In 2024, more than one in three counties had a new lead election official since the 2020 election. Some counties experienced multiple transitions at the county auditor position between the two presidential election cycles. The Elections and Voting Information Center out of Reed College produces a national survey of local election officials, and they noted in their 2023 survey, I believe, that turnover among election officials was twice as high as it had been in previous years. An encouraging finding from that survey, though, was that job satisfaction among election administrators remains generally high, but respondents also reported increased levels of stress from their work. Fortunately, although there was a high level of turnover in Minnesota, we also saw experienced and new election administrators step up to meet the challenge. Election administrators across the state went the extra mile to assist their colleagues in making sure that they were prepared for their role during this busy year and were able to find answers to their questions. Our team also recognized that turnover would be a challenge this election cycle and devised strategies to help meet the evolving needs of election officials. In early 2024, we deployed North Star, a resource sharing platform that provided a library of training tools for county election officials. We continue to add content over the course of the year to address specific training-related needs from the counties. We also streamlined communications to the counties, providing weekly emails that outlined important updates, key pieces of information to be aware of, and upcoming deadlines. We also partnered with counties and the Sourcewell Service Cooperative for an overdue update and modernization of our election judge training videos. These videos were made available for local jurisdictions to help with building or supplementing their election judge training curriculum. And we continue to phase in updates to our election administration and election judge guides. Our office is also responsible for administering the biennial County Election Administrator Conference that takes place in the spring of the even years. In 2024, this conference saw record attendance, reflecting the growing number of county staff that are involved in administering elections, as well as the increasing need and desire for more training content. The design of the conference was modified to include more opportunities for panel discussions and small group breakouts to gain from the experience and insights of election officials from across the state. We also expanded training offerings to include additional pre- and post-conference learning modules. In addition to this conference, staff from our office offered online statewide trainings, office hours sessions, and one-on-one check-ins for brand new election administrators throughout the year. Our election officials are an incredibly talented and resilient group, and one that understands election administration is a true partnership, from the state to the counties to the municipalities to the election judges. It takes all of these parts operating together to make it work successfully. And one area of our elections division that really embodies this partnership is our Election Security Navigator program. And Mr. Chair, with that, I'd like to be able to turn it over to our Election Security Navigator, Bill Ekblad, for that portion.
One thing, Mr. Linnell, you had mentioned county auditors. Do you specifically have training that pops up after a new auditor is elected or appointed, depending on which county?
Mr. Chair, that is something that our office has been working to build out and designed a module in 2023 and is looking to continue expanding, providing additional training content specifically for onboarding new auditors. I think that was a finding that really depending on the situation and the resources available at a particular county, there may have been little infrastructure in place to be able to account for an unplanned transition, particularly at the auditor level.
Well, thank you, and I eagerly anticipate the materials in regards to that program being shared with the community. And your name and position, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Bill Ekblad, the Election Security Navigator in the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State. I've been with the office about 5 years now. Prior to that, I served on active duty in the U.S. Navy for about 27 years in various information and cybersecurity roles. So I'm here today to talk a little bit, give some background about our Election Security Navigator program and how we support our county and local election officials to protect their people, their processes, their equipment, their information, and ultimately the voters that they serve in their jurisdictions. Our program, like a handful of other ones like it, was born in the wake of the 2016 presidential election, in which it was later revealed that a handful of states were targeted by a foreign adversary for cyber intrusion activity into their election systems and structures. We quickly ramped up in late 2019 to sort of focus on that cyber threat that was expected in the 2020 election from foreign cyber adversaries. Fortunately, we did not see that threat, thanks to a number of reasons, including some federal activities that partnerships that helped tamp some of that down. But nonetheless, we spent a lot of effort in the 2020 presidential election season to help our counties prepare and be aware of the threats that were out there and the resources that were available to them to help protect against those threats. As we came out of the 2020 presidential election season, we started to hear concerns from our local election officials about the physical security of their staff, their team, their offices, and similar. So we worked with them to kind of fold our cybersecurity model into that physical security domain to raise awareness of resources and assets that they could take advantage of, which I'll talk about here in a minute, to help assuage their concerns about physical security. Thankfully, once again, the 2022 election season did not produce a lot of physical threats or activity targeted against election officials. So as we came out of that season, we were really not doing so well in terms of batting average and how we were at predicting the types of threats that our election officials should be concerned about. So when we approached the 2024 election season, we decided to take a much more general preparedness and readiness approach for our efforts and really seek to have our elections officials think very broadly about what they can do to be ready for anything. And that was really the message that we carried through last year. Next slide, please. So our approach really is based on tying together all the stakeholders with an interest in election security. Clearly, that's our county and local officials down to the township or city level, and as well as a vast array of partners that we work with and tie together. So we'll talk more about our partnerships in a minute, but really it's about how we connect all these entities and stakeholders, the ways that we can enable information sharing, encouraging this see something, say something approach, which has worked so well in the anti-terrorism environment for the last 20 or 25 years, and overlaying that on election security so that when there are concerns at the local level, that officials are comfortable speaking up, reaching out, and seeking assistance to make sure they feel safe and secure with what they have to do. We have, as I mentioned, a wide array of partners that we bring to bear from the federal level to other state agencies. We have academic partners, some vendors that are involved, and some nonprofit groups as well, all of whom want to do the right thing for the right reasons, to help deliver safe and secure elections for Americans and for the people of Minnesota in our case. And we also work with election officials to help them convey to their populations the importance that they be seen as the trusted sources of how elections are protected and kept secure, so that when people have questions, they turn to those local officials to get the accurate story. In terms of our local focus here within the state, we really are focused on the systems that connect our state office with our local county officials down to the county level. So the ways that they access voter registration systems, election night reporting systems, and the like, and ensuring that the counties and local officials appreciate their role in protecting and securing those systems and that information is a key focus for us. I should say, too, that as Mr. Linnell mentioned, we do not focus on the voting systems themselves. There's a rigorous system in place at the federal level to test and certify all aspects of that. We do not get in the way of that. We really focus on the support systems that enable the administration of elections at the local level. So the desktop machines that are used to conduct the day-to-day activities of our election officials at the county level, local level, make sure they're appreciative of the security requirements needed to guarantee the security of those systems to help deliver that safe election. Again, we focus on making sure there is wide awareness of the resources that are available to take advantage of by our election officials from the federal government on down. And we also do work to distribute grant funds when available. We have conducted a couple of grant efforts, the most recent of which was in 2022, in which we distributed that Help America Vote Act funds, about $3 million, downstream to local governments for applying to election security. Next slide, please. So I mentioned our wide array of partners. We work closely with a number of federal agencies, most significantly the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA. They have had an election security function for the last several cycles and have personnel that focus on that area as well. We partner with the FBI, including here locally, for issues related to direct physical threats and cyber threats and crimes that may be in the election security lane. We have contacts at the U.S. Postal Investigative Service. As some of you may know, there was a series of mail-borne threats over the last couple of years related to white powders and so forth, and the Postal Service is deeply involved in those types of issues, and we partner closely with them. We also are tied together with a couple of national-level associations that work in this lane, so the National Association of Secretaries of State and the National Association of State Election Directors are two that we work closely with for resources and information sharing, and a couple of sort of quasi-governmental federal-level type agencies as well, the Information Sharing and Analysis Centers, the ISACs. There's one that focuses on elections and one that focuses more specifically on cybersecurity support to state and local governments. That's the MSISAC. We work with them. And then here at the state level, we work closely with our partners at MNIT for all things related to cybersecurity and making sure that our elections partners are aware of those local state resources, as well as the BCA, who their Fusion Center is constantly on the lookout for specific elections-focused threats that we can help ensure awareness of. And we have some partnership with the National Guard as well for some issues related to cybersecurity and others. Next slide. So how we do it, we really have a number of ways, a number of prongs, if you will. We are tied together with our partners at the local level 365 days a year through a series of online collaboration platforms. We use those to share situational awareness of things that we're tracking and aware of, to hear their concerns, to foster discussion and dialogue, and again, really that see something, say something approach that we bring down to the lowest level. We've conducted a series of tabletop exercises to sort of spawned some thinking and processes among our officials and how they might react in certain scenarios in advance of significant election events, just to kind of prime the juices, if you will, to get them thinking about how they can be focused on securing their elections. But maybe most significantly is we get out there. We are in person. Our team of three last year visited all 87 counties. We think our in-person presence is key to building the relationships and the trust that our county officials can leverage when they see something they're just not comfortable with. We don't want them to feel that anything that they're observing or concerned with is too small to get in touch with us to help us help them put the pieces together, to share it with others, and to figure out what's going on. So it's all about that local level trust building, and in-person relationships are key to that. And with that, I will turn it back over to Mr. Linnell to continue. Chair, if you don't mind. Please.
Just a couple of quick things. And you're talking about you're working together closely. Do you have a report of the number of events or incidents and the different classification and what was done to correct that? Because I know there have been some that were very publicly noticeable, and I assume that there were those that were not. And then I'd like to understand how you track the chain of custody and what sort of improved measures you're suggesting with that. And then the other thing is curiosity about nodal AI sniffing to prevent or contain if there is an event. And if you want to
yes, Mr. Chair.
Cover that offline, but anything that you could give us quickly.
Well, I'd say first and foremost, in terms of incidents that we have tracked, we do sort of keep track of that and could produce a summary of some of the things that that we certainly paid attention to over the last couple of key election cycles. Your question about chain of custody, Mr. Chair, is probably more relevant to Mr. Linnell's administrative lane and the processes that exist for that. And then, I'm sorry, the last concern?
Nodal AI sniffing for to contain stuff so that there was some sort of issue, it's contained locally and wouldn't, get to the main system.
So there are a number of cybersecurity aspects and details obviously in place. Maybe better to address those in a separate forum, but certainly happy to work with you and the committee on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I can certainly take a crack at that question. I'm also going to cover some of that in the next portion as well, so whatever your preference is.
Whatever works more fluidly with your presentation.
Okay, sure. I'll press ahead, and if you want to interject at any point, please do so. So next, I'll take a deeper dive into the 2024 general election, starting with absentee voting. So absentee voting for the state general election got underway on September 20th, 2024. We saw robust turnout throughout the absentee voting period, both in person and by mail. More than 1.3 million ballots were cast via mail or absentee ballot, which, as Secretary Simon noted, was close to 40% of the total votes cast for the election. Other than 2020, when we saw those record numbers, this was the highest rate of absentee voting that we've seen for any election, and a big increase from the rate in 2022, when that was at roughly 27% that voted absentee in person or by mail. In-person absentee voting in 2024 included an expanded 18-day period where counties could provide the option for voters to insert their absentee ballot directly into a ballot tabulator. In previous years, this was limited to just the last 7 days before Election Day. We saw that more than half of all absentee ballots that were cast in person were cast during these last 18 days. There was also additional time this year for absentee ballot boards to process accepted absentee ballots, again, similarly expanding from 7 days to 18 days. This helped to ease the administrative burden of opening and processing absentee ballot signature envelopes during that busy final week before Election Day. The general election was also the first time that two additional weekend days, the second Saturday before Election Day and the Sunday before Election Day, were open to voters. Additional weeknight hours were also added to the Tuesday before Election Day. These proved to be popular, with more than 120,000 in-person absentee ballots that were accepted over the three weekend days. Voters really took advantage of in-person voting in those final days before Election Day. Of the total in-person votes before Election Day, more than 20% were accepted during those final 3 days. The Monday before Election Day was the busiest of the entire period, with close to 90,000 in-person absentee ballots cast on that final day. Several counties also deployed additional temporary absentee locations during this period, including temporary locations on tribal land, if requested by the tribe, as well as temporary one-day campus locations, and the flexibility for counties and cities to offer additional in-person absentee voting options that had different days and hours than a full-time location, which is required to be open for that full 46-day period. The absentee voting period also saw increased attention around chain of custody. This was due in part to a publicized incident involving the transfer of sealed absentee ballot signature envelopes from municipal locations to be counted at a central county location, where boxes were left unattended for a period of time. In this specific incident, the county took swift corrective action to address the situation. Due to the layers of safeguards and security protocols that were in place, the county could review the materials that were returned and determine that all ballot signature envelopes were sealed and accounted for, and that none were missing or tampered with. Both the county and our office spoke in strong terms that the incident was not acceptable and did not follow chain of custody procedures. Our office shared additional reminders and guidance to all counties regarding chain of custody requirements and practices to ensure this incident is not repeated. Looking forward, we've discussed ways with counties that proper chain of custody can be further enshrined and standardized across the state, including looking at legislative solutions to further enshrine chain of custody. In polling places across the state, Election Day went smoothly for election officials, election judges, and voters. As Secretary Simon noted, roughly 30,000 election judges stepped up to the plate and worked long shifts so that nearly 2.4 million voters could cast their ballot on Election Day. As with every election, there were some issues that came up during the course of the day, but thanks in large part to the extensive training and preparations that went into the election, there were a few incidents that were reported on Election Day. After the close of polls, election judges must tie out that the number of voters that signed the roster equals the number of votes cast. Election results information is then delivered back to the county office, where results from each polling place are combined with the results from absentee and mail ballots. Results data files are then uploaded or hand-keyed into the Secretary of State's election reporting system. From there, the results files are published to the public election night results webpage, where unofficial results are posted. Our office worked to communicate with media, candidates, and the public prior to Election Day that with the absentee ballot return deadline moving from 3 p.m. to 8 p.m., that results were expected to start coming in later than in recent years. Several counties did experience a high volume of absentee ballots that were returned during this period. Each one of those ballots needed to go through the absentee ballot board review process before it could be accepted and counted. Although the timeline did shift to later in the evening than usual, nearly all counties were fully reported in the very early morning hours. We've had initial discussions with counties about approaches to managing the return of absentee ballots with this later deadline and results reporting expectations. There were also a few counties that experienced issues related to posting unofficial results to the Secretary of State's website. During the upload process, incorrect or incomplete files had been uploaded to the election reporting system. When a results file is uploaded for a precinct, that causes the precinct to show as being reported in the system. So when incomplete results files were submitted, the results page may have showed that a contest had 100% of their precincts reported, which is correct to say that each of those precincts did have results reported, but there were still additional or corrected data that needed to be posted for those precincts. So the results were not complete in those instances. As soon as the issues were identified, the unofficial results were updated and corrected on the Secretary of State's website. We've had discussions and are looking at possible options for how unofficial results are displayed to help make this clearer in the future, and are looking at opportunities to work with counties on the results upload process to ensure that sufficient verification is taking place prior to the posting of unofficial results. In the days following Election Day, county election officials audit and proof the summary statements from the polling places and from absentee voting. It is these summary statements that comprise the official record. The results that are posted on our website on election night are always unofficial. This proofing process is an important safeguard that can identify issues like those that occurred during election night. It ensures that the results are accurate and all statistics have tied out before being presented to the county canvassing board to certify the results of the election in each county. Across the state, counties canvassed the results between 8 days after, within 8 days after Election Day, part of an expedited timeline to comply with changes to the Federal Electoral Count Reform Act. Another role that the County Canvassing Board plays is selecting the precincts to be included as part of the post-election review. After every state general election, precincts are randomly drawn to be included in a public hand count audit for the races of president or governor, U.S. senator, and U.S. representative. This is a required audit that takes place in all 87 counties between 9 and 14 days after Election Day. The number of precincts to be counted depends on the number of registered voters in the county, with each county needing to count at least two precincts. The hand count results are compared with the results from the machine counts of ballots cast on Election Day and all absentee ballots. The results from the hand count cannot deviate from the machine count by the thresholds outlined in statute, which are essentially 0.25%. This threshold was tightened in 2021, a law change that our office supported. If the difference does exceed the threshold, further precincts need to be audited all the way up to the possibility of the entire county being counted by hand. And again, in 2024, the results of these post-election reviews affirmed that the voting equipment used in elections across the state and counting the ballots were accurate. The certified copies of the county abstracts, along with the completed post-election review reports, are then submitted to our office to be presented to the state canvassing board. On November 21st, the State Canvassing Board met to certify the results for federal and judicial offices and state offices whose boundaries fall in more than one county. The State Canvassing Board also certified the results of this year's constitutional amendment question. Following the completion of the appropriate canvass, a losing candidate may request to have the results of their contest recounted. There are no automatic recounts in Minnesota. It must always be requested. But if the difference between the winning candidate and the losing candidate is within the margin defined in statute, one half of 1% for most contests, then the requested recount is publicly funded. For contests that fall outside of those margins, the losing candidate is responsible for paying the costs of the recount. There were recounts at all levels that took place following the 2024 election, as there are in every election cycle. Similar to the post-election reviews, these recounts are another key transparency measure in publicly affirming the accuracy of election results. Vote totals and recounts do regularly have small changes, but this is almost universally the result of cases where the voting equipment could not determine voter intent. So, for example, if the voter circled the candidate's name as opposed to filling in the target. But the recount process consistently demonstrates that the voting equipment accurately counts the ballots. Minnesota law also outlines a process for resolving election disputes through the contest process. Election contests must be filed within a defined time frame following the completion of the appropriate canvass. In 2024, there were two election contests filed, the residency challenge in House District 40B and the contest in House District 54A stemming from a discrepancy in absentee ballots. The district court opinion in 54A provides a detailed recounting of what took place in that incident. Proper procedures were not followed at the city location during the absentee ballot board process, and those actions resulted in ballots not being properly handled and counted for that election. As has been mentioned earlier, the number of ballots must always be balanced against the number of voters. In the case of absentee envelopes, this is represented by the number of accepted absentee ballot signature envelopes. When numbers are not properly balanced and accounted for, it opens the possibility for errors to take place. We've reviewed this incident and are looking at ways to work with local election officials to avoid a recurrence in the future through additional resources and guidance, as well as exploring potential legislative changes. As we turn the calendar, our office will look at ways in which we continue to improve the election system for both voters and election administrators alike. We'll seek to build on the partnership between state, county, and municipal election officials and identify opportunities to enhance transparency, security, and accessibility in our elections. We welcome any feedback, input, and questions from this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that I'll turn it back over.
Thank you, Mr. Linnell. Earlier, you had mentioned if a voter hadn't voted in the previous 4 years in a January analysis, can you again state what happens to that voter on the rolls?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. So as part of a process that's referred to as annual list maintenance, basically if there's no activity for that voter record, if they haven't updated their registration or they haven't voted in at least two state general election cycles, so one gubernatorial cycle and one presidential cycle, their voter record is inactivated. So they would need to re-register if they wish to vote, get back on the voter rolls and vote again in an upcoming election.
So that also counts for the permanent absentee ballot list that you clean that?
Correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For a permanent absentee voter, if they are inactivated as part of the annual list maintenance process or for any reason, if they move out of the state, if they pass away, that would deactivate their status as a permanent absentee voter.
Thank you. I believe Representative McDonald had a question and other members. Oh, we've got... I want to make sure I get you on the list. Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Linnell, in one of your slides, I think it was the one right before it, before your questions, yeah, there was you spoke about the cost of a special election or a recount to the candidates. Could you clarify that? Did I hear that right?
Thank you, Representative Mr. Linnell. Mr. Chair. That's correct. So there's two different types of recounts based on the difference between the losing candidate and the winning candidate. And statute essentially outlines that if the margin is at or below that threshold, then a recount that's requested by the losing candidate is paid for by the public. Essentially, the jurisdiction that is responsible for administering that recount would foot the bill for bringing in election judges and all the associated costs with the if it's less than that margin, they would the jurisdiction would be paying for that. If it's outside of those margins, the losing candidate, again, can still request that recount, but they would be provided with an estimate for what it would cost, give them a sense of that figure, and they can determine, yes, I want to proceed with it, and then they would be responsible for paying the full costs of that recount. There's some exceptions that are outlined in statute. If there are certain margins that change during a discretionary recount, as it's called, so if the candidate would be responsible for the costs unless, you know, there were to be a substantial error that would then result in the public footing that bill.
Mr. Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, that's right. I was aware of that, and I'm glad you clarified that and just reminded me of the particular statute. Do you think that the state statute should be changed to, in the case of 40B, or in any case going forward, where a candidate knowingly lied about whether he's or she is a resident of that district, and there is a special election, do you think it would be prudent if the state would change the law that special election would be paid for the person that was dishonest?
Mr. Liddell.
Representative, Mr. Chair, I don't know if I would have a comment about the requirements for who would be footing the bill. I mean, that's specifically for recounts as opposed to the cost of administering the election. I don't know that there's anywhere else in statute that would have, a someone who's responsible for paying those costs. I think it's, I'm not aware of anything that would account for.
No, members, that question gets us into what the legislative intent, if somebody wanted that, there could be a way that the county or the person incurring the cost would be able to do a suit for that expense caused by a criminal act. But that would require some special legislation, I believe, by us. So the department can sort of interpret the law and legislative intent and tell us about results, but it's not... Unless it's a procedural thing, it's not really their onus to be able to tell us what we need to change or pass. So I don't want to have us, ask them the question, well, what, would you agree with this law? Their job is to follow the law and give us the information. So just, for future reference, Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, I still had some questions, though. Thank you. Is that permissible? Yeah, no, I'm well aware of how to pass laws and what happens in this place after my 15th year. Just as he's our state director of elections, I just wanted to get his opinion and advice in that case. I personally think that would be a doable thing to do in our state and a very fair and reasonable law that in this case or any case going forward, that a person that was not honest and there's a special election, that that shouldn't cost the taxpayers in the county or the state. That should be paid for by the person who is dishonest. So we are already working on that bill. I think I've seen it or heard that there's some legislation being drafted, and it should be fair, and I hope that all agree that fraud and lying is not going to be tolerable at all in the state. I just wanted to get your opinion, Mr. Linnell, and your expert advice. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. So I just want to shift gears a little bit to the election security piece and that infrastructure. I am looking at slide 22 if folks are interested. So I want to bring that attention to the election security infrastructure that you were talking about. I noticed a number of federal agencies here. And so I think, like, whether you're on this side or that side of the aisle, I think everyone here wants to make sure that, you know, we maintain integrity in our election system. And so I'm just curious if you can tell us a little bit, and this might be a question for Mr. Lionel also, about how important this collaboration with federal agencies is, and, you know, what would happen if funding to these agencies were cut, and what impact that would have on the Secretary of State here, and if that would mean that, you know, they would ask for a larger budget.
What I'm going to do is, because you got three of you sitting there, I'll go back to you first, and you can hand it off, and if you state your name for the record, or, you know.
All right. Thank you, Chair Quam. I'll hand the first half of that question over to Bill Ekblad.
Thank you, Mr. Snell. Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm Bill Ekblad, Election Security Navigator. So clearly we partner closely with those federal agencies, I think all of which have personnel here stationed permanently in Minnesota that we have personal relationships with. Their partnership was especially critical as we got our program off the ground, and they helped us sort of learn the ins and outs of what the federal government can provide to a state entity seeking to assist locals in protecting their elections. And they continue to provide that support daily as we need it. And so I think when we talk about the criticality of that support moving forward, I would say that we have learned a lot about what's out there and how, and what we can do with our own effort and resources, and could muddle forward if that support were curtailed or eliminated. But clearly it has provided great benefit and support to us as an office that we then funnel downstream to locals that protect and secure the elections.
Thank you, Chair. And then the second part of that question, you know, what happens if we have significant cuts to the federal budget? And what kind of impact does that have then on the Secretary of State's request to the legislature to support that gap?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. So I would say that there are certain types of threats to elections that we are very limited to do much about in terms of awareness here at the state. When we talk about threats from nation-state actors to try to meddle at a local level in elections, that's just something that the state doesn't have the resources to keep up with. So that type of support is especially critical from the federal level. And we would be hard-pressed to replace that. There are some vendors out there large IT type vendors, cybersecurity vendors, that can provide some of that at cost and seek to fill some of those gaps. But I would say that would be the greatest area where we would notice a significant decrease in federal level support. But we could find a way, and we would do the best we can, but it would be at a detrimental level.
Follow up, Representative Lee. Representative Altendorf.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for testifying today. So I just want to go over a couple of the dates. I don't know who's answering these for me. But when does the data from the counties need to be uploaded to the Secretary of State? What is that date?
Representative, Mr. Chair, Paul Linnell, State Elections Director. So the counties have a six-week deadline after Election Day by which to enter voting history for records. There's the entry of Election Day registrations, which has the possibility of an extension depending on additional time needed to enter that of another 4 weeks. But those two deadlines coincide at 6 weeks after Election Day.
Rep. Altidore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Linnell. And so you spoke about the dates to contest election, and do you remember what that date is? So December 17th, you said 6 weeks. So November 5th was the election. December 17th would have been the deadline for the counties. And when is the date to contest elections?
Mr. Linnell.
Representative, Mr. Chair, I don't have the timelines. I'm trying to recall if it's 5 days or a week. But after the appropriate canvassing board, so depending on which office it is for, whether it's canvassed at the local, county, or state level, there's a defined timeline. I want to say it's within a week after that canvassing board certifies the election that there's the opportunity to file a contest. It varies by if it's a primary or a general election as well.
Rep. Altidore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the contested, the date to contest an election is before the 6 weeks, so December 17th. So I just want the whole committee to understand that timeline is out of date, you know, because a candidate would not have the data information before the time that it's due from the counties. It is before that deadline. And then I also want to ask you, Mr. Linnell, we were talking about the absentee ballots. And this year, the Secretary of State stopped reporting absentee ballot accepted on November 1st. And could you answer to the committee, why did that stop getting reported as of November 1st?
Ms. Linnell.
Representative, Mr. Chair, could you speak specifically to the reporting that is this the publicly requestable accepted absentee data, or that is a list that's requested and paid for through our office, or is this higher level statistics that are posted?
Rep. Altendorf.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Mr. Linnell, when I was paying to get data requests as of December 29th, there still was not, the lists were not available from the Secretary of State. You know, I'm just going back to one of them. December 29th, that would clearly be way after the election. That was still not listing the dates that the absentee ballots were accepted after November 1st. So there was a time period, November 2nd to November 5th, that the Secretary of State did not have the listed dates of when those ballots were accepted.
Mr. Linnell.
Representative, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that we've been made aware of that issue, so if there are specific reports that we can take a look at and see, but the public information list, whenever requested, is the live snapshot of registered voters at that point in time and would include all vote history data that was entered by the counties through, again, that date and time. So it would include everything up to and through election.
Mr. Linnell, it'd be nice to have Secretary of State, when he comes back, add some of that background information so that we can get the clarification questions. Rep. Altendorf.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Linnell, now we talked about the date of the counties that it was due on December 17th. Could you please answer how many counties did not make that deadline, number one? And number two, is it acceptable for counties to be changing their data after the deadline of December 17th?
Ms. Linnell.
Representative, Mr. Chair, I do not have the county entry numbers in front. I know that it was all, if not all, nearly all counties that had their data entered by that point, and if it wasn't, it was, I think, getting the last few across the finish line for those counties, but we can also look and provide that.
We will eagerly await clarification and more fully declarative data. Is it okay if we move on to Representative Freiberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions about recent changes that we made to the law. So Secretary Simon talked about some of the outreach efforts the Secretary's office went through related to Restore the Vote, and I think those efforts are great. I was just wondering if anyone from the office had any sense for how many voters took advantage of that who were not previously eligible, like either raw numbers or like a percentage turnout or something along those lines. That's my first question.
Mr. Lindell.
I'm going to defer to my colleague, Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Chair. Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. I'm the Government Relations Director. So with that, we don't yet have the data on how many of those folks. There are some partners across the state that are working on comparing the publicly available lists with others. So I expect later this session that we would have more information on that. Yeah.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. Yeah, just when you get that, if you could share that, that would be great. And then the second one is relates to the second question I had relates to the voter fund. So last session we created the fund for local governments to be able to apply for state funding to handle some of the election-related infrastructure costs that they deal with. I got an email this morning that had a report on it, so thank you for sending that. I haven't had a chance to fully digest the report yet, but I was wondering if there was any top-line conclusions you had about how much of the funds were expended, you know, anything that could guide us in determining whether or not we should fund that at a similar or higher level during the upcoming session.
Representative, Mr. Chair, I can field that question. Certainly the response and the data that we received back from the counties as well as their municipalities that received some of this funding as well showed that it was very well received, and for a majority of counties that the funds were expended during the period of time. It was a little bit of an awkward alignment between the grant reporting time period and this election cycle, and that the reporting period ceased on June 30th, when obviously a lot of election-related expenditures were just about to take place for the state primary and the state general. So for the counties that did not expend their full allotment of funds, it may be that they were planning to spend those during those summer and fall months. But I think we saw north of 75-80% of those dollars being expended. But we did know and hear from some counties that were considering saving up some of those funds and rolling it over to accrue a higher amount to pool for a larger, you know, voting equipment purchase. Generally, the categories that we saw that were most used, though, were related to voting equipment, hardware, and software, as well as staffing expenses, primarily for election judges, particularly down to the local level.
Rep. Freiberg?
I'm good. Thank you.
Rep. Altendorf? Oh. Pardon me. Representative Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can the Secretary of State's office give us just a brief explanation or tell us how the money from HAVA was spent this last biennium.
Mr. Lindell.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I'd be best placed to defer to
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. So I would need to reference our quarterly reports to the EAC. Generally, what we have been spending HAVA dollars on is both updating to our statewide voter registration system, as well as supporting our security navigator team. So those are sort of the two top line things that the Help America Vote Act dollars that have been previously allocated have been used for. The $1 million that was talked about at the beginning, that those dollars weren't used, weren't spent in the last biennium.
Rep. Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Freeman. So do HAVA dollars get spent more in one county as opposed to another?
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Davis. So the historically over the time that Help America Vote dollars have been allocated, as the Secretary mentioned, they have come in different chunks of money. And so I'm trying to remember what year it was. Was it 2018, 2019?
Yeah.
That there was like $3 million of $3 million of those security election funds. Those were granted down to the local level, and so those were allocated based on, I think we factored in
per capita,
and then also a flat rate. So out to any counties that applied for them. I think cities also were eligible to do that. And this last round of $1 million, right now we haven't granted any of that down to the local level.
Because we do have some more people to testify later. If your question is about data that obviously isn't available, I think we need to have you and your people come back at another meeting, because there seems to be quite a bit of wanting to get details. There's one more follow-up question from Rep. Altendorf, and then I would hope that we could move on to the office administrative hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much again. If you could give us a little bit of the background on what is the Secretary of State's office specifically doing to make sure our voter rolls are cleaned up. So if there's a death, how are we checking the voter rolls? If someone has moved, that type of thing. If you could just give us a little bit of update.
Mr. Lindell.
Representative, Mr. Chair. Yes, so these are our updates that are taking place daily out at the county offices across the state as data is coming through from some of the sources that I mentioned. The Department of Health and the Social Security Administration, when death records come through from those sources and there's a match with a voter record in the system, that information populates in a county queue for them to process and update that record and mark it as deceased. Specifically on that case, there's other ways in which a voter can file a request, and that certainly happens as well when a loved one passes away, that they'll fill out that form and submit it to their county office to let them know that they've passed away. Some counties also get down to the level of looking through their obituaries regularly as a cross-reference and maybe identify that record before it comes through one of those other processes. The United States Postal Service change of address request process, whenever those requests come through, that again populates when there's a data match in those county queues to update the record, moving from either one county to another, moving within the county, or when someone has moved out of state. And that process triggers a notice to be sent from that county out to the voter, and there's a 21-day period before that record is inactivated. I can keep going on some of the others if.
Well, Rep. Altendorf, is it okay if they give us a report since 2016, how many of each type have been corrected or changed, so we understand the consistency across, especially since that's the year that there was the audit of the registration system?
Mr. Chair, certainly we can look to get some of the statistics around the number of updates and changes to records based on that information coming through those sources.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And so basically what you're saying is you're leaving it up to the counties, right? I mean, the counties are doing this. There's not something particular happening from the Secretary of State's office. It's the counties.
Representative and Mr. Chair, so by statute, the county auditor is responsible for handling those voter records. Our office hosts and maintains the voter registration system that transmits that data. So as far as how the system is designed to pull in data from those other sources, and if there is a match, set it up in that queue so that it's there for the county to process that record. So that is part of the ongoing responsibilities that each county auditor and their staff manage.
Well, thank you, Mr. Linnell. And to Rep. Altendorf and other members, in 2016, the registration system was audited, and the Secretary of State's office and the counties did not verify over 16,000 bad registrations that were done through the HAVA system, and that's publicly accessible to be able to review that data. And so that's why we'd like to have an idea of how you've progressed since 2016. But I want to thank you for coming and testifying. And I would like to invite Mr. Lippman.
Eckblad, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Pardon me. Sorry. My apologies. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jenny Starr, and I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. My plan here today was to give you just a couple of sentences about the Office of Administrative Hearings and then introduce my colleague, Administrative Law Judge Eric Lippman, to give you more detailed information on our Fair Campaign docket.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, for those of you who may not be familiar with me, Jenny Starr, I've been in state service for over 18 years, the first six of those as an attorney at the Department of Revenue, then six as an assistant commissioner at the Department of Revenue, and the past six in this role of chief administrative law judge. And I offer that to you just as an offer of shared value. My values in state service, as I know exist for many of you, is being an energetic, responsive, and respective service provider to the state of Minnesota. The Office of Administrative Hearings was established in 1975 by the legislature. We opened our doors in 1976. We were the third state in the country to enact this kind of executive branch court, and we are today the largest of three courts that sit inside the executive branch, the other two being the tax court and the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. To give you a sense of size, our bench is 32 judges, which is the same size of bench as Ramsey County District Court, our 32 judges, and our administrative professionals who support them serve the entire state of Minnesota with physical locations, courtroom locations in St. Paul and Duluth. Now, our jurisdiction is broad. This handout should be with you today. We receive over 10,000 new workers' compensation cases each year, over 700 administrative law cases. We also have a rulemaking docket and a boundary adjustment docket. And our purpose in all of these matters, including our jurisdiction over fair campaign cases, is clear and set by statute and includes the important purposes of increasing public accountability in government in Minnesota, as well as simplifying the process of judicial review. And with that, I will pass it to my colleague, Administrative Law Judge Eric Lippman.
Thank you, Madam Chief, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Eric Lippman. I'm an administrative law judge with the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. We thought the thing that would be of greatest value and of most interest to this committee, because it's in your title on elections, that we would give a little bit of a review, and I have some statistics here, about the recent experience of Fair Campaign Practices Act complaints and resolution of those complaints over the last two cycles. Again, there's great variability in the number of complaints that come in, but these are complaints both of state candidates and also of local candidates on violations of chapters 211A and 211B, things about disclosure practice, disclaimer practice, contribution practice outside of the 10A context. A similar regime as the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board for state candidates also applies to local candidates under Chapter 211A. And so there are significant campaign finance questions. The key six takeaways that I wanted to give to you so we can be respectful of your time are also on this sheet. I think the first is the good news is that OAH is doing the job that the legislature had set out for us in 2004. In 2004, the legislature found that there was a significant problem with local campaigns because the predecessor process was to refer all of the claimed violations of campaigns and candidates to the county attorney for investigation. A familiar practice was to make a complaint to the county attorney about your opponent and then promptly do a press release on the eve of election saying my opponent is under investigation for serious financial and campaign misconduct by the county attorney. He's a bad person or she's a bad person. It didn't matter to the filer whether that complaint was resolved either before or against. The value to the filing campaign was that they could have this kind of nastygram on the eve of election, which wouldn't be effectively rebutted. The legislature regarded that as a pretty sharp campaign practice, not in our best tradition, and so wanted a system where complaints could be quickly reviewed and resolved and, if need be, dismissed before Election Day. So what I've done here is in the statistics in both of these cycles is showed you the filings that were made within 30 days of the election day, and then you know, our track record on resolving them. And you can also see the timelines, 14 days before, 7 days before. And depending upon the year, we're getting close to half, if not more, of those complaints resolved before Election Day. So we think that that significantly reduces the incentives for the kind of gameplay that the legislature worried about in 2004, which is that you would do a gotcha complaint that was frivolous, and then that wouldn't be resolved before Election Day and have that, you know, it takes the fun out of it, as it were. If you could say, not only was that complaint, you know, frivolous, but the judge threw it out, and to have that result early on within certainly a near news cycle. And you can tell by the number of days to resolution, the closer that you get to one or three suggests that those things were immediately dismissed without even a response by the campaign that was filed against. So among our takeaways, we resolved half or more of election cases before Election Day. Even of the most complicated, we're resolving them within 60 days. And so compare that to the other kinds of litigation that you might be familiar with in the district courts. I think that's a really good statistic, and it's also showing that OAH is Minnesota's rocket docket. We're getting these complaints resolved and resolved quickly, even though they might be involving sophisticated or complicated campaign finance deals. We have the lightest touch possible on candidates and campaigns. Again, a significant number of these cases, the ones with the check marks, were all dismissed early on in the process with either some or very little or none at all response by the campaign that was filed against. So we're avoiding the significant due process concerns that the Supreme Court has worried about dragging candidates unwillingly into court on complaints that aren't legally founded and basically hassling them when they should be talking to voters. And that, I think, was a significant concern of the legislature and a job that we're doing pretty well, in my estimation. There's still campaign practice violations, a lot of them. There were 84 cases in the 22 cycle filed in 2022, and 43 filed in 2024. Again, the case numbers are variable. What I think you can tell from this sheet is that a small number are state candidates. Most of the campaign conduct violations are candidates for local units of government, mayor, city council, school district, water and soil board, I assume, those kinds of things. And we think that that points to a direction, if you want to try and boost compliance, I think that we should have some informal, we're not asking for an appropriation or anything, but informal relationships to do some training, much like folks do in the context of rulemaking. The Interagency Rulemaking Committee is a completely volunteer, self-supporting organization that trains new people to the field. We think that under-resourced campaigns tend to be at the local level. If you're running for city council for the first time, you probably don't have a huge campaign staff, a lot of treasurers or other officials. We think that that might lead to a compliance problem. You know, having greater knowledge about Chapter 211A, I think would be a really good thing, and maybe someplace where the legislature might want to point the partners. I know that the Association of Townships, League of Minnesota Cities, visits this committee often. I think that they might well be good partners on maybe even the Secretary of State's office, on training local candidates how to be good candidates and good campaigns and have more campaign hygiene so that we're not having these disputes either at all or close to the election. With that, both the Chief and I are delighted to answer members' questions.
Well, thank you very much. And I would think that the Campaign Finance Board could be a key cooperating entity within that whole function. I believe Representative McDonald has a question.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Do we refer you to Your Honor or Judge Lippman?
However you wish, Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Well, Your Honor, question on your bulletproof, bullet number five, or no, four, the lightest touch possible. I think I know what a lightest touch is, but could you be a little more descriptive of the practice and procedures?
Sure. Mr. Lippman.
Comment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, The Supreme Court, in a case called SBA List out of Ohio, expressed considerable doubt and worry that Ohio's version of what we do, the Fair Campaign Practices Act, and submitting their campaign practices to a tribunal like ours, but not nearly as light a touch as ours, actually violated the due process protections in the 14th Amendment, that they were so heavy-handed on interrupting candidates and campaigns, drawing them into court on basically the say-so without the kind of legal review that our office does, that touch upon campaigns and candidates burdened their First Amendment rights, because they were so susceptible to frivolous cases. I don't think that that's the problem here in Minnesota. Again, we're clearing out things which don't have a legal basis before there's even a reply from the campaign that's targeted or the candidate that's targeted. I think that being sensitive to those due process concerns is a really important feature of what we're doing. As recently as last Friday, the U.S. District Court for the District of Minnesota struck down another election law, 200.13, I think it was, about foreign-induced corporations participating with independent expenditures. So the federal courts are very sensitive to this topic of not burdening election-related speech, and I think that if we want to continue being helpful, we've got to be on the right side of the due process guarantees. I think we are, because of the kind of legal review and general sensitivity that we'd much prefer candidates and campaigns talk to voters than to judges.
Ms. Starr, did you want to illuminate anything more on the topic?
Probable cause review.
And then what's the next one?
Is the evidentiary panel. Yeah. So as Chief Judge Starr points out, that there are three levels or three layers to our process. There's that initial prima facie review. Is this, if you believed everything that the complainant said, is that such a thing? Is that a complaint? Many times there aren't. You know, they're just mad about things which aren't legally an obligation of the campaign or candidate that's responding. And so we dismiss those within 3 days. Again, not troubling the candidate. I think that's a great feature of our process. The next level is a probable cause hearing, which is, would a cautious mind believed that based upon the evidence that we have, 10 days in or 5 days in, that a violation has occurred? That's a second level of review. That would have the candidate involved and usually say, I didn't do that. Here are some other documents that suggest that, I did what was appropriate. The claim is not true. And so, again, it's a less generous standard of review. The first standard of review is, if we believe them, is this a thing? And then the second is, would a cautious mind believe them? And then the third level is a panel of three administrative law judges. And those cases do happen because sometimes violations do occur. Again, my concern about the volume of cases and the number of local candidates and campaigns that are involved in some form of genuine misconduct suggests that we need some more training and better campaign hygiene. That's our next frontier of giving value to the state.
Thank you. A follow-up?
No, thank okay. you. Thank you very much.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Judge Lippman. Nice to see you. You referenced that a lot of local candidates are under-resourced, and I guess I was just sort of, I was curious. I mean, certainly when you get into election-related challenges involving our legislative caucuses, we've provided a lot of business to attorneys working on election-related issues lately. I'm curious, though, when you're talking about like a candidate for a small local jurisdiction, they don't have those level of resources. So I imagine you get a lot of unrepresented candidates bringing complaints. I'm just curious if you have a sense for what percentage that is, how much leeway you give them. I mean, I assume their filings are, don't necessarily comport with the rules of court all the time, and just what sort of assistance you give to them in that sort of situation.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Freiberg, thank you. A couple of points I would make is that across all of our work, not just in the campaign context, but I'll talk about the campaign context in a second, across all of our work, depending upon how you count, between a quarter and a half of all of our litigants represent themselves. We take that as a point of pride in that you don't need to hire a lawyer or incur legal fees in order for you to get prompt and significant justice and a tribunal that cares about what you have to say. So I think that that's an ethos that is chock-a-block right through. In the elections context, I would suggest that most of these people, with the exception of the people who represented the campaigns for state office, appeared pro se on both sides, nearly all. And again, we are, I think, a fair and welcoming and accessible tribunal. You don't necessarily have to hire a lawyer at all to get not only a fair hearing, but to prevail. You know, this is not a barrier that we're putting in. And again, for us, that's a real point of pride and a valuable public service. I think the problem is that when you have some inadvertent misconduct, didn't put disclaimers on things, or the proper disclaimer, took excess contributions, didn't file on time, these, you know, and let's say it's absolutely inadvertent and the candidate cops to it when they come in, they're involved in this court process. I think going upstream, just in the same way that you solved a problem in 2004, the next frontier, I think, is getting better hygiene and local folks not having to hire an attorney, but knowing, you know, how to stay out of trouble.
Just by watching the interaction here, I can tell that your court is not like we see on TV. That you care about the people before you, and you're friendly for giving advice and that. And I must commend you, Representative Freiberg. Oh, apparently that's it. Any other? No, it's a pleasure to have somebody that is so caring about doing the right thing and helping people. And I want to thank you for your testimony and helping us to understand what you're doing. And again, thank you very much. If there are other questions that come up, you may get some emails, or if you have information for us, let us know. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Lippman. Members.
Yep. Since we are moments away from the end of our committee meeting, everybody should have received a copy of the rules. They are not that different than almost every one you're used to. The big things are, you know, testifiers, you know, we want them noon the previous business day, amendments noon the previous business day. So when it's a Monday, it's noon Friday. Wednesday is noon Tuesday. There's the flexibility on technical and oral amendments, but we try to have an amendment to the amendment be more of the technical. Otherwise, it would just be, you know, more of a standalone. If you've got any questions about the rules specifically.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question under number two, attendance, and then number B. Members arriving or departing during a hearing must inform the committee legislative assistant or committee administrator. So should a phone call arise or a restroom break is needed or whatever is necessary, we should what? Notify the chair, be acknowledged, or sneak out and do our business and come back in a stealthy manner? What's your recommendation?
The least would be, you know, let your neighbors know you'll be back. But, yes, if you can let staff know. And they keep a nice little list of who's, you know, asking. So that way they know I'm trying to pay attention to the, you know, testifiers and the members. And Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of to that point, I know there was some discussion during the power sharing negotiations that were occurring in December that, you know, there would be an accommodation, you know, even members on both sides of the committee. And I believe that there was some discussion, too, about each co-chair being able to approve absences and so forth and excuse members So I assume those sorts of discussions will be back on the table in the event we return to a 67-67 split in the legislature.
Representative Freiberg, I am not in the upper echelons of the leadership, so...
Me neither.
The things roll down upon us, and we will adjust. My whole philosophy was pretty standard rules, and, you know, if something comes up and we agree that, you know, it didn't make deadline, but we want to talk about it, then we, you know, can work together in a cordial manner. So I assume there will be dictates and constraints coming down from up above, depending on the results of the upcoming election.
So, sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Otherwise, we are adjourned.